And I don't know why the Marine Corps even asked the University of Pittsburgh to study this. That means there are some woke people in the Marine Corps who probably ought to be removed. This isn't good for the military. It's a little bit more of the leftist insanity that seems to have gripped America. And at some point, we just have to say no to it all.
Knight says any policy the military adopts should be geared toward readiness as the ultimate goal. I'm Chad Groening.
More news online at AFN.net and download the AFN mobile app for your Apple or Android device. I'm Rusty Pete.
You're listening to FirstAmendmentRadio.com worldwide. Freedom is never free. We need your support today at FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
Good day, everyone, everywhere, and special greetings to all those seated in heavenly places in Jesus. The name of this broadcast is Cross the Border, and I'm Nicholas, and this is a live prophecy reality edition. Yeah, come here once a week, every Wednesday morning, so people must be forgetting because people are not showing up. Anyway, good to see you there in the chat room, Fireman Mike. Okay, let's see, First Amendment Radio. I've been working on our Mobi app. If you go to firstamendmentradio.com or .net /MOBI, you'll get our Mobi app. And I now have on the Mobi app, I have a page. Let's see, where's that page at? For the chat room. I believe this is it here. Nope, that's not it. But if I click on this button here, you'll see there's new buttons on the app. And there's one that says video chat. So if you go to that one there, it opens up to the same chat room we have in our chat room and also has a screen there, a rumble screen, live screen that 24/7 plays First Amendment Radio. So, wherever you're at, whatever you're doing, you can go to, listen to First Amendment Radio. All the podcasts are available, and I'm still working on it. You can see the buttons at the top. Four of them are operative, and three of them are not yet, but they will all be operative. Give me a couple weeks. But I got far enough. So far I have the opening page, which is the listen page, and it has First Amendment Radio live stream at the top, and then all of the podcasts for the entire week. You just, you press the forward arrow there and it goes to the next day. So, there's all the programs for the week are there and they're all updated hourly on First Amendment Radio. We have automation to do that. Computers. Imagine that. So the programs within an hour or two at the most, but usually right away, they get uploaded. And so a program that was just played will be available almost immediately, you know, give it 10 or, you know, maybe 10 minutes after the top of the hour when it ends, and it will be uploaded there. Everybody hearing me good? Forgot to turn my voice monitor. There, I can see my voice now. And so that's how that works. And then I have one with the people on it there. So you click on that. There's links there right now, but I'm still working on it. I'll get some graphics and stuff, but I have links to all the web pages for the programs that we have on First Amendment Radio. There's more to be added. That's the page I'm working on right now. So getting the links there was the first thing I needed to do. And then I have a give page, the one with the red heart symbol. Thank you for that sound check there, Fireman Mike. And if you click on that, you'll see, I say thank you for your faithful support. And please make out checks, money orders as follows instructions so you can give to us because of the banking situation. We don't have a bank account that says First Amendment Radio. We have a trust account where all the money goes to that. And then it's credited to First Amendment Radio. And our trustee is over there. I mean, our treasurer trustee is over there. Getting the mail, and you know, making sure that all the money gets in the right places and everything gets paid for. So there's instructions there for giving. And as it says, Mark of the Beast CBDC is slavery. And I've got a little notice on there. You can read it for yourself. Because of the increased financial targeting of conservative organizations, we are preemptively backing away from PayPal at all and asking our supporters to mail cash, checks, money order, or gold and silver to the above address. And there's a PDF. You can print labels. You know, you can print a label if you want to label labels to mail us a check or money order or cash every month. And we do get all the cash. Nobody sent us cash and we haven't got it yet. And I'm going to do something, make sure people get noticed either by email if they give me an email with their donation, or I'll send them a card acknowledging their donation if they send it by mail. But sometimes it takes a little while. So that's all there. And then I've got three more buttons to fill up, and I'm sure I can find stuff to put on all of those. So developing the Mobi app, it's a web-based app. You can't find it in the app store. You can only open up your browser on your cell phone, on your stupid phone. I call them stupid phones. They call them smartphones. I say stupid phones, but open up a browser on your stupid phone and go to firstamendmentradio.net/Mobi and then save a link to that on your Surface. That's how I have it on my stupid phone, if I can show it to you. And, yeah, you can see right there that I have it on my phone. And, if I clear that, you'll see that I have a link on my Surface to that. So all I got to do is press that link and, it opens right up and starts play. Well, it doesn't start playing. You have to push the play button on that app. Although it does, it's supposed to autoplay on the net, but it usually doesn't. You have to start it. And then if you go to the opening page, which is our play page or a listen page, there's a refresh button there. It's a green refresh button on the very right. Because if you stop it when it's playing like this, it pauses it and it'll pick up later on. So if you want to pause it, and you can pick up where you left off in case you need to interrupt what you're listening to. And your device will pause it where you left off and pick it up. But if you want to pick up at the current spot, you got to press the refresh button. So that's all the instructions I'm going to give you on the Mobi app. But do remember it. And then send a link to everyone in your list so they can listen to First Amendment Radio. This is the only way. With shadow banning, we have no other way. So first get the link on your cell phone and then text it to everyone on your list so they can listen to First Amendment Radio and be affected by the gospel, okay, and the truth of God's word and a biblical worldview, because we want to give them all those things. And that way you can do that. That can be your evangelistic part, is to share the First Amendment Radio Mobi app on your device, since they can't get it in the store. But for those people who insist, we do have, as long as it will be in the Google store, is the Prophecy Reality News app. You can listen to that too. I have both on my phone. It depends on what I'm doing, which I prefer. So you can figure out that too. But as far as getting to all the podcasts quickly without a lot of ado, I believe the Mobi page is going to be the best choice from now on, especially with the improvements that I'm making to it at this time. Okay, well, that's all we're going to say about that. I hope you all will enjoy that and take advantage of it. All right, news, current events in this first hour. And in the second hour, we've got two more installments of the Jorge Apocalyptica for you. So you'll want to stick around for that in the second hour. I am posting all these on the First Amendment Radio YouTube page because they're not giving me strikes for that yet. Yeah. So when it becomes more blatantly Antichrist driven over there at Google, YouTube. Well, I believe they're shadow banning me because we do out the Antichrist here. I believe that is the whole reason that we're being shadow banned on YouTube, Gab. We weren't allowed on other places like, what do you call that, Rockfin, and other places won't even allow us on. So they have even have stricter code of silence or censoring than YouTube. Yeah, some places do, because they don't allow anything Protestant, evangelical, Bible teaching, or Bible-based on their platforms. Those are a good place to fish, if you can get there, but if they don't allow you there in the first place, you can't fish there. At least I can throw my, hook into the pond at YouTube and fish there anyway, because I consider it their pond, you know. And I'll fish in their pond as long as they allow me to. When they kick me out of their pond, well, I guess I'll be done there. Okay, so anyway, we got news here. Elon, and this from Babylon Bee, are your most trusted news source on the net, besides First Amendment Radio, that is. Elon to stay as Twitter CEO after counting mail-in ballots. So just like the elections in America, if you don't get the result you like, you can count mail-in ballots and you can keep counting ballots until you get the result you want. Good job, Elon. It's really kind of idiocy to put that poll out there. Doesn't he know that most of the people on Twitter are not going to like what he's doing? Yeah. Well, I think we should pray for this guy. Yeah. It might be facing his mortality soon, because he talked about, I'm not suicidal, you know, last week, and then they tried to attack him and his son, X, or something. So I think that's his son's name, X. Yeah. It's my son, my ex. He's not my ex-son. It's pretty weird anyway. But hey, even Elon Musk could be saved, you know? I don't know if his name is already written in the Book of Life like mine was from the foundation of the world. We don't know. So we can pray for people like Elon Musk and even shameful Donald Trump, who introduced the jab and shut down the country and, sometime in the last week, he had a gay gala event at Mar-a-Lago, you know, just to prove to all those people out there who thought he was a baby Christian and saved. Well, he's not. I'm sorry. You know, you don't throw gala events to celebrate, the new Gay Marriage Act at Mar-a-Lago, without offending your Christian base. So I think these things, he's his own worst enemy. I think that there's not a chance, in Hades anymore of Donald Trump becoming president. And I think by 2024, it will be, more than evident. I could be wrong, but yeah, it probably will be DeSantis, but all politicians come with baggage and none of them can be trusted. Yeah. The corrupting nature of man, it's just too easy to be corrupted. And we all have to admit, you know, there, but, for the grace of God go I. All right. Well, let's see what else we get from, I think they had a couple more here. They had a lot of advertising, but I did like this one. Bruce Wayne polls Arkham inmates asking if he should step down as Batman. And same results as Elon Musk. So, yeah, you got to be careful what you ask for. Yeah, thank you for that. Let's see. Hallmark researchers say they're close to developing a second movie plot. I guess that's just supposed to be funny. Maybe that's Hallmark Network. But they've gone in for the whole, they bought in for the whole, gay mirage thing. And, so Hallmark's done with now. And I'm done with them. So never mind about that. Let's see. Blithering idiot of a husband arranged throw pillows in wrong order. I guess some people might think that funny. That's the married people comedy there, I guess. Here's one. Washington Post lowers flag to half staff for journalists suspended from Twitter. Okay. Chris Tomlin proud to unveil completely new and original Christmas song, Silent Night. Yeah. And that's it. That's all we get from, that's our laughs and, our giggles for the day. Now we have to get into serious news, right? And I guess the question of the day is, if we go with this one here, no, this one. Yeah, this one here. What's love got to do with it, right? Oh, no, wait a minute. That's an old song from the past. It's, what's the government got to do with it? That's what we're going with. What's the government got to do with marriage? And I found this article because I've been thinking about this for months on and off, thinking about writing an article about it. And voila, you know, somebody did it for me at The American Thinker. Although I might have wrote a little bit differently, a little more Bible-based. But anyway, it's something that I can play on here. The government should get out of the marriage business. I could not agree more. That's the title of the article over at American Thinker. There's a way to undercut the left's sustained attack on religion, expressed most recently through its assault on traditional heterosexual marriage. The answer is to take government out of marriage. You know, while continuing to allow it to control what are essentially the business aspects of two people joining together. There's a way to undercut the less sustained attack on religion, expressed most recently through its assault on traditional heterosexual marriage. The answer is to take government out of marriage while continuing to allow it to control what are essentially the business aspects of two people joining together. The Respect for Marriage Act is no such thing. As a legal brief, and as legal briefs so commonly say, Tanya Bergoggle has clearly shown, arguments are incorporated by reference herein. While she discusses marriage's proper role in society, space likely prevented her from reviewing the government's role in marriage. So let's begin at the beginning. With ancient colonies, with ancient colonies, and that's one thing that I really didn't like about the article. It only goes back to the beginning, to the American colonies. In the southern colonies, while marriage was performed before a magistrate, divorce was unacceptable because the Church of England did not sanction it. And actually, there was no marriage licensing in early America. And there hasn't been really any marriage licensing, except where governments are totalitarian, or it was illegal to marry someone from another race. That was in America. So you needed a marriage license to marry someone who was not your race. And the fact is this, in a free land like America, nobody needs a marriage license to be married. Okay. I've been married several times. I've been married. I delegated that authority. It was delegated to the pastor and the church that I was at. And we had our own church, marriage certificate with witnesses signing on it. And on it, it also had our vows that we made to each other and so you don't need to have a marriage license from a state to get married. And I've discussed this before. And there's no reason for the government to be even in the marriage business at all. What do they need to know even if you're married for? Okay. For paying unlawful taxes, you know, if you signed up for that, if you signed up privately and contracted with the Social Security Administration and the federal government to fill out a 1040 inquisition form every year, and then they have a marriage exemption there or something where you pay less taxes. But I think it's just head of household now. And so they need some way to quantify that on their legal documents. Once you accept your position as a slave, because that's what the whole thing is about. It's about your position as a slave. You're owned by them, so you have to report to them and fill out 1040 financial inquisition forms every year. And that's the only reason the government now needs to. But why do they even need that? And that's what this article pretty much outlines. Okay. He says marriage was an explicitly secular act in the New England colonies. New England civil courts could dissolve marriages, but did so only rarely. And so there is a part in marriage for dissolution, because marriage, because all those things needed to be announced publicly if you were going to be married, because you couldn't have someone going out there and marrying someone that was already married, whatever. So there are some checks on marriage that really need to be recorded publicly, but the government does not need to be involved in it for any reason whatsoever, except perhaps in recording relationships. And that's where this guy gets to. He goes on, courts also awarded property and typically granted child custody to the father. So this is a court action. Because children were regarded as economic assets, the concept of the welfare of the child developed later when the economic value of children declined. Yes, how did that happen? Today, he says, in my home state of Florida, a judge, pastor, even a notary, I got mine to officiate my grandson's wedding, can legitimate a marriage. Similar laws exist all across America. He says nothing about the Bible here. The Bible is every man and woman's license to marry according to the dictates of the Bible, right? Okay, you can't hide one marriage while you marry someone else. You're not supposed to marry someone else. You can't remarry someone that you divorced before, according to the Bible, that married someone else in between. Anyway, we'll pick up here when we get back from this break. This break just came too fast. Okay, I'll be back in a few minutes. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Cross the Border. This is a live prophecy reality edition.
Hear it first on FirstAmendmentRadio.com and FirstAmendmentRadio.net. The program you are listening to is 100% sponsored by you, the listener, on this First Amendment Rights Media channel. You will notice that there are few commercials on this radio network. There's a good reason for that. Corporate advertising dollars come with strings that limit program content. So without your help, these programs cannot continue on satellite, internet, or our several affiliates. If you benefit by the educational law programs, we ask you to give. If you are admonished or nurtured by the Bible and ministry programs, we ask you to give. If some voice a cause that you are passionate about, we ask you to give. If you believe in any of these, we ask you to support them as you would a missionary on a continual basis, as if giving a tithe for missionary radio. These programs are not commercially viable and must be supported by those faithful to the cause of truth. Look for the button to sponsor your favorite programs at our listen and schedule pages on the internet. We will also give you unlimited archive access to all of our programs. We're asking you to give much less than a tithe so that you may also send support directly to a particular program host, cause, and anywhere else the Spirit may lead you. Do all to the glory of our God and Creator, for His holy nation, the only kingdom that will last forever. Thank you for listening.
Since the beginning of time, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it, it has been traded, it has been borrowed, it has been purchased, it has been stolen. There's a reason for it: to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and to our posterity. Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188 or visit discountgoldandsilvertrading.net. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, right here on firstamendmentradio.com at 4 p.m. Eastern or 1 p.m. Pacific Time. Visit discountgoldandsilvertrading.net or call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, 1-800-375-4188.
Well, when I left off, I was talking about marriage and what's the government got to do with it. And I guess the answer would be, should be absolutely nothing. I think that was the answer to another song. War, what is it good for? Okay, so anyway, if we look to the Bible just briefly, we know that God joined the first man and woman together. So they definitely had a license from God to get married because God made Eve for Adam. But then as we go through the families of the patriarchs and Israel, we see that it was the father of the bride who had the honor of officiating the wedding. The father of the bride, imagine that. And that's the way it still should be today. We still have a vestige of that left in most marriage ceremonies, although at least most in the last century. I don't know what's going on today out there. All kinds of bizarre stuff, but okay, I hope this is an actual call and not just another interruption. Your name and where you're calling from? Yep. Okay. So we had the father of the bride. That's what we get. So that makes marriage a family rite. Now the church tries to claim it. Of course, the Catholic Church claims everything it can. Some churches today claim that it is a religious and church rite, but it is not. The Bible clearly demonstrates that it is a family rite, meaning rite being short for ritual. Okay, it's a family rite. It's a family ritual. It belongs to the family. It belongs to family government. And I was talking about that vestige of that is left in most marriages, and especially most over the last century, that where the pastor, who has been delegated that family authority by the family itself, see, because you have the right to delegate authority if you have it, right? And so most families delegate that, or most Christian families delegate it to the church. I did that with my last wedding. I delegated to the church where I got married. And they didn't require a license from the state to marry me because they were not a 501c3 church. Okay? So it's a family right. It's not a state right. It's not a state government right. It's not a church right. But the family can delegate it. Well, they could delegate it to the local magistrate if they want, or the ship captain, whatever. Or the father of the bride can do it himself, because that's what I see demonstrated in the Bible. So that's where the right really belongs and where it's vested by God, apparently. Okay, I see nothing else in the scripture about the church having the right, owning that right and having that authority. But as I said, it can be delegated. And so this author, anyway, he goes into Prima Nocturne and what David's son Absalom, he digresses in the article. So we'll just skip that part there. He says, today in my home state of Florida, a judge, pastor, even notary can officiate a wedding. Yeah, you can delegate that authority to anyone you want. To Mickey Mouse if you want, I guess. But the fact is, you don't need a state-issued license. The IRS, whatever agencies, the driver's license, they all accept a marriage certificate that is a bona fide marriage certificate. And you can make up your own, get your witnesses to sign it. You can have it officiated at church, but just it has to be, and it should be announced publicly, because that's part of it. Is there anyone who has any reason why that's the other lawful part that is added? And that's why marriages are supposed to be published, so that if anyone has a reason, I know that guy is a scoundrel, he's got three other wives in six other states, or six other wives in three other states or something. So, you know, just to make sure. But, you know, usually it's young people that are getting married, and everyone knows, their families know that, you know, the guy is only 17 or 18, maybe 20, and he doesn't have six other wives in three other states. And there's no other reason. He's not promised to anyone else. He's not betrothed, or the wife's not betrothed. That's why the question is asked. Is there anyone who has any reason? It's a legal question for the legal standing of the parties being married. If they don't have that legal standing, that it would be exposed at that point rather than later when more damage can be done. Okay. And that's the legality of marriage there. But like I said, what's the state got to do with it? It should have absolutely nothing to do with it. And then speaking of licensing, see, God gives a man and a woman a license to marry, according to what we read in the Bible and all the stipulations and everything that's contained in the Bible that has to do with marriage and being eligible to be married. Okay. And that's why we would ask the question, is there anyone who has a reason why these two should not be married? But the state, because God won't give certain parties a license to marry, because he does not. God does not give a man a license to marry a man, or a woman a license to marry a woman, or to marry their dog, or whatever. Or three men to marry two women, or anything like that. There's no license in the Bible for any of that. The Bible only says what it says, and it says some things are an abomination, so they're definitely not licensed by God Almighty. So all God's people and every man and woman already has a license to marry, and it is in the Word of God, because, you know, let every soul be subject to the higher power, the higher authority. And who is the highest authority of all but God Almighty? He is the higher power. And if you're subject to him, then you're subject to every lawful authority below him. And if there's a lawful authority below God that is in disagreement with God's law, then that is no authority at all. It may be a power. They may have the power to persecute or even kill you or punish you, but their authority is an illegitimate authority. And their power is a usurpation of power. So anyway, let's get to the meat of this guy's article here. To those of us with Christian backgrounds, find the concept of gay marriage repugnant. Amen to that. Homosexuality and its related sexual deviances, such as Sam Brenton, Rachel Levine, Brittany Griner, come readily to mind, may not be the province of the state to regulate, but blessing them with the epithet of marriage is morally obscene. God created male and female. The divine mandate is for one male to become husband to one woman and vice versa. But relegating marriage to a secular status pushes it back to the state's authority to affirm or deny. So is the Bible going to deny anyone the right to marriage that God says can be married? Well, no. They don't have the right, but I guess in some governments and some ages and some totalitarians would and will do that. And the government likes to get authority and money for licensing anywhere they can get it, you know? One thing about dictators and tyrants is they're in love with power. Anyway, the article continues. At this point, the linguists jump in. While most dictionary definitions speak of weddings and so on, marriage has been much larger semantic range. Its broader sense, it speaks of matching two things, not necessarily people, and joining them together. Obviously, this is parallel to the wedding ceremony, but that's primarily because things in a wedding are people and are joined together. The matching and joining are the root concepts. Thus, referring to the two people joining their lives as a marriage is less than exact language. A different choice of words would eliminate the moral revulsion of Christians at gay marriage, gay mirage, while retaining all the legal nuances. As far as the state is concerned, let's rename this joining process as a life partnership. I think they already call that. I saw in some thing the other day that someone introduced this other guy as his partner. I thought, oh, they're in business together. Well, yeah, they're in business together, all right. It's monkey business. It's sin business. But anyway, this is a more exact term and completely lacks religious connotations. It directly expresses the intent of two people to share their lives, whether religious or not. It also focuses on legal issues involved. And so anyway, there's this article, and it's at AmericanThinker.com. But I think that we need to, that the government, but I don't think they're going to, arrange the affairs so that it just gets down to legal definitions and a shared legal ownership of property. And that's basically what it gets into. These two people are having a partnership, a sharing of property for business or otherwise. And there has to be a legal or contractual agreement there. And the government's only business is upholding the law of contracts, and mainly that through the courts rather than what it allows and doesn't allow. As long as the contract is lawful, then it has standing in the courts. And that should be the end of it for the government and marriage. There should be no Obergefell. There should be none of that. It's just that these evil people, they wanted the same status as lawfully married people. They couldn't get it from God because they can't rewrite the Bible. So they got it from their God, the state. And that is essentially what worshiping the beast means, is that you put the state in the place of God. You make the state your highest authority, and that way you worship the beast. And that could be even considered a mark of the beast. So when you see two people that are not married by the law of God, but married by the law of the state, contrarily, you can say that they are worshipers of the beast. And that thing that they're flouting and putting on display for everyone to see in their life is a mark of the beast, or a mark of their allegiance and worship of the beast. So we know what happens to people that worship the beast and its image. Well, they all end up in hell, unfortunately. So if anyone's listening, they don't like what I'm saying, all I can say is repent. You know? But don't try to say that God has changed his mind because the government of man has changed their mind. God has not changed his mind. And you've accepted another God, another authority, to give you license to do that which God says is unlawful and an abomination. And I think that's about all I need to say about that for now. Okay, well, let's see what else we got. Boy, I could do the whole 2 hours on news. Should I or should I not? Well, nobody showed up. I don't think really anybody cares what I have to say anymore. Maybe I'm just doing this because I think it's fun. Yes, and necessary. There is a message here. Yeah. Everybody getting the message? Yeah, well, that could be another reason why I'm so unpopular, is the message. Okay, let's see what else we got here. I found another article. Is America falling like Rome? And last week I talked about the barbarians from the south. Yeah. And so, like me, someone else wrote an article on when the news of the Battle of Saratoga reached Britain, a young Scottish barrister told economist Adam Smith, "If we go on at this rate, the nation must be ruined." And Adam Smith responded, "Be assured, young friend, there is a great deal of ruin in a nation." And by that he meant that a nation can absorb a lot more blows than pessimists tend to think. And boy, that's become so obvious today. I think Adam Smith had something going on there, if he could say that. And it's definitely proved to be true, because America has taken a lot of blows and, has not fallen yet, but it is falling. And whether it will still be falling when Christ returns, well, I guess that goes without question. After quoting Adam Smith's answer at the beginning of the article, and after reviewing the ills that beset America, Victor Davis Hanson, I guess writing on, had a very concerning article on the future of America, concluded his reflection with the following statement. We have seen lots of cultural revolutions in this country, but never one that's so singularly focused on raising the foundations of America until now. Yes, there's a lot of ruin in great nations, but even America is by now running low on it, meaning that the ruin is becoming so great that it's becoming likely to fall. In all fairness, it has to be said that such a terrible sentence perfectly reflects the reality of the country as it has become today. We are $31 trillion in collective debt. The military is politicized and short of recruits, and they're killing people as fast as they can. He doesn't realize that in this article, is that they're killing people, that the genocide, the forced euthanasia is on purpose. American people are witnessing the breakdown of basic norms essential for civilized life. Says old Cairo seems safer than an after-hours subway ride or stroll at dusk in many major American cities. Medieval's London's roadways were likely cleaner than Market Street in San Francisco, not to mention the fact that speech was freer in the 1920s America than it is now. Nor can the abject, deliberate humiliation suffered in Kabul be forgotten, when the worst U.S. administration ever decided to flee and abandon to the terrorist Taliban a huge, remodeled airbase, tons of billions of dollars in military hardware, 1 billion embassy, and thousands of friends. In addition, FBI is corrupt and discredited, collaborating with Silicon Valley's big tech companies to suppress free speech and warp elections. And it goes on and on. That's the state of our nation today. And it's a very sad state of a nation. But there is a nation within a nation. And there is a nation that covers the whole earth and is within all of the nations of men. All the temporal nations of men have in them another nation, another constituency. Not the people of the world, but the people of the kingdom of heaven. And that is the kingdom that will last forever. And that is the cure to all the ills, because the kingdoms of this world are passing away very quickly, as we can see. And how long before Christ comes and obliterates them all? Not long. You know, even if it's 25 or 30 years off, it's not long. And for those of you that are curious and wonder what the Bible would have to say about that, I have an article on my website. If you go to crosstheborder.org or nicholasarthur.wordpress.com, you'll see an article up there at the top. It says, "What year is it?" And it has an outline in it from the scripture itself that traces a chronology from Adam and Eve. Well, specifically from Adam being created on the sixth day and Eve. And to today, driving as much of that timeline up through the time of Christ, we have that complete timeline in the Bible itself, with a few very small gaps. So it's not exact. I'm going to say that it's within a few years, 2 or 3 years, at least, or at the most would be the difference between, and I have the year, the final year is 2055. So you might want to check that out for yourself. I'm hoping it's a little sooner, but unfortunately I can't, you know, by all of my study, as much as I desire it to be sooner than 2055, I can't make it happen that way. And I can't, you know, delude myself into believing that, oh, it's immediately or it could happen at any time. No, there are specific things in scripture, in the prophecy that have not happened yet and are going to take some time to happen. But I believe that all indications are that we are that close, because 30 years, 25, 30 years is what it would be now. 2055, that would be 30 years from 2025 to 2055. So, I'd have to hang in there. Yeah. I'd be a very old man if I live till Christ returns. If it's going to be 2055, that means I have to live another 33 years. So I have to be well in excess of 100 years. And just, you know, I don't know, looking at 100-year-old people, it doesn't look that desirable to be honest. Sometimes I think even now I'd just as soon go home, but no, I, there are things I want to do. I would like to finish the projects I'm on right now, and I would like to see, at least one of my grandchildren or a couple of them take over the work here that I've begun so that they can continue it until, and it looks like that'll likely happen. Still praying about that one there. And my daughter does work with me, but her heart is not really in it yet. And so that's going to take a change, that I can't make, because you can't force anybody into the kingdom of God. You can only pray for them and pray that their name is written in the Lamb's Book of Life from the foundation of the world. And that when, God's Spirit moves on them, then it will become clear, yeah, where everybody stands and what the outcome will be. But the only one that we can really make sure of is ourselves, and then be that example for all the ones we love so that they have an example to follow in, to live a godly life, and to walk in God's kingdom. And we all pray for all those we love continually, that we will see them in the resurrection. Because there's really, that's the most important thing, is to make the resurrection. Because what good is it if 100 people are saved by the work I do, and I miss it myself, right? Yeah, that's, what would that be like? And here I am at the end of the hour. It came too soon. I guess like David Knight, I'm going to need 3 hours if I keep this up, right? But no, I have too much other work to do this every day for, and we have lots of good programming, lots of good news programming. So I like to get on here and give a little of my biblical worldview on the news as I can. But in the next hour, I'm going to go ahead. I have this all queued up. When we come back from the news, I will begin to play the next two segments in the Horae Apocalypticae. And those two segments are, let me look them up right here, right now. Number 11 is the mode, the manner, the plan, and order of the revelation from E.B. Eliot. And then number 12 is chapter 5 of his introduction, ensuing historical exposition. So it's kind of an introduction to what comes next, which after that would be the six seals opening. So that'll be next week. Well, that's all the time I have in this segment. I will come back after the news and introduce the two segments of the Horae Apocalypticae. So don't go anywhere. I will be back.
Calvary. That's the place where Jesus bled and died, and it's there that sin has lost its power. At Calvary. Calvary. There my Jesus won the victory. There he gave himself for you and me. On Calvary.
Years ahead of the dominant media, FirstAmendmentRadio.com. FirstAmendmentRadio.net.
For American Family News, I'm Chris Woodward. More snow is expected to hit western New York, where a deadly blizzard struck over the weekend. Fox Weather's Max Gordon is in Buffalo with more.
A lot of people here in Buffalo woke up to additional snowfall this morning. We're now over 4 feet of snow here in the Buffalo area with several more inches left to go. Really, the duration of this event has been one of the biggest challenges for people here. And unfortunately, 27 people here in Erie County are confirmed dead. Folks have been found in snowbanks, frozen to death. Several people have been found in cars. And unfortunately, in some cases, emergency workers just haven't been able to get out to folks because the roads have simply been too bad. Thousands of people are without power, and workers are trying to get the power back on.
The Buffalo Airport plans to remain closed until tomorrow. Drivers are still being urged to stay off the roads in Buffalo and some surrounding areas. Frustration continues for thousands of passengers who have had their post-Christmas travel plans upended by flight cancellations. Here's Fox's Tony J. Powers.
Forecasts had already marked December 27th to be the worst travel day of the holiday season, and it's living up to it thanks to a brutal winter storm. Thousands of flights are already canceled today, with more than 2,500 belonging to Southwest, shaping up to be a repeat of yesterday.
They're saying that first it was weather, then it was the holidays, and then now flight crews are all displaced.
He's flying Southwest and stranded in Boston. Southwest's CEO tells the Wall Street Journal they'll operate about a third of the usual schedule to allow crews to get to where they need to be, and the Department of Transportation officials say they're looking into the cancellations.
Well, as we have reported on AFN, Congress passed a nearly $1.7 trillion bill to fund the government last week. Tennessee Congressman Tim Burkett tells Mornings with Maria he believes it spends too much.
We are literally going to lose our country as we know it if we do not get control of our budgetary mess that we're in. We're over $30 trillion in debt,
right.
And that's just unbelievable.
For more on the spending bill and what it funds, visit AFN.net. A drag queen show touring the U.S., Canada, and the U.K. is a lascivious performance that one Christian commentator says aims not just to groom children, but actually recruit them. Bob Kellogg has this story.
A drag queen Christmas seems to attract many single mothers who happily take their children to these performances, which include partial nudity and graphic sexual content that can't be described in this report. Lori Higgins is with the Illinois Family Institute.
Nothing better illustrates or provides evidence for the presence of the demonic in our culture than this whole sexual anarchism was experiencing. This is a real affront to Christianity.
The show, up until now, has been promoted as an all-ages show, but Higgins says recent backlash has prompted the promoters to begin backing off.
St. Louis, Missouri, or I think it's like a suburb called Chesterfield, Missouri, they have changed the designation on their website that this is for 18+, 18 years and over. I think the controversy now is beginning to lead them to make some changes.
Fortunately, in the United States, the tour concludes this week. I'm Bob Kellogg.
In world news this hour, the UN human rights chief is urging the Taliban to drop restrictions on women. Japan is requiring COVID tests for all visitors from China. And speaking of China, military drills between China and Russia are wrapping up after nearly a week. In final news, the national average for a gallon of regular gasoline today is $3.10. That's down from $3.55 on this day last month. Diesel will set you back an average of $4.67 compared to $5.22 at this time last month. That's all my time for now. Find more news on AFN.net. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and subscribe to our free daily email news briefs on AFN.net. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back. You listened to Across the Border. This is a live prophecy reality edition, and we're going to continue our exposition of the Horae Apocalyptica, actually the audible reading of it as I'm recording it and updating it for a new edition, which I'm likely going to publish on Amazon when it's done. And I'm going to try to get this thing done within a year. That shouldn't be too hard to do. It's not going to be easy, though, because there's four volumes. Is that right? Four volumes, yeah. That's a lot. But I'm already, as far as I can tell, I'm already more than halfway through volume one, because I'm just getting to, as far as my recording is concerned, not my playing out, but my recording, I've got to the end of the seventh seal and in beginning the trumpets. So I am proceeding regularly, and I should get this done. Like inside a year should be easy at the rate I'm going. But it means I have to let off a lot of other things that I would like to do too. But once I start something, and I just have to make it a priority to get it done. So quite an undertaking. But anyway, the Horae Apocalypticae is the most exhaustive work ever done on the Revelation. E.B. Eliot, through his lifetime, did five editions of it, okay, continually updating it. And if he had lived until today, which is impossible, but if he had, he would have done probably 10 more editions on top of that to bring it up to date, because prophecy is continually unfolding in history or being fulfilled in history. So whatever's fulfilled needs to be included in the book. And that's what I'm doing with this edition and what I did with the last edition that I did. This one's just refining it and making it more readable because it was problematic. Tom Press was going to read it, but he told me that, I thought about it. It's just too hard to read. And he was right. It is. So you can imagine what I have to do to make it more readable. And that's exactly what I'm doing. But I figure if it makes it more readable so that I can actually read it out loud in an audible version, that should make it easier for everyone to read it. So that's kind of the effort here, without excluding anything. But I'm moving some things to the footnotes. So everything will still be there that was there. And some of the archaic language will be brought up to date, so it's a little more easy to read. But anyway, I'll run out of time if I don't start this, so let me start it right now. Horae Apocalypticae, Volume 1, an historicist commentary on the Revelation, updated and revised for the 21st century, derived from the original work of E.B. Eliot. Read by yours truly, Nicholas Arthur. Part 1. First Six Seals. Introduction. From the Temporary Prosperity to the Fall of Pagan Rome, A.D. 96 to 395. Revelation chapter 6. And I saw when the Lamb opened one of the seals, and I heard, as it were, the noise of thunder. One of the four beasts saying, Come and see. And I saw, and behold, a white horse, and he that sat on him had a bow, and a crown was given unto him, and he went forth conquering and to conquer. And when he had opened the second seal, I heard the second beast say, Come and see. And there went out another horse that was red, and power was given to him that sat thereon to take peace from the earth, and that they should kill one another. And there was given unto him a great sword. And when he had opened the third seal, I heard the third beast say, Come and see. And I beheld, and lo, a black horse, and he that sat on him had a pair of balances in his hand. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four beasts say, A measure of wheat for a penny, and three measures of barley for a penny, and see thou hurt not the oil and the wine. And when he had opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth beast say, Come and see. And I looked, and behold, a pale horse. And his name that sat on him was Death, and hell followed with him. And power was given unto them over the fourth part of the earth, to kill with the sword, and with hunger, and with death, and with the beasts of the earth. And when he had opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of them that were slain for the word of God, and for the testimony which they held. And they cried with a loud voice, saying, How long, O Lord, holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth? And white robes were given unto every one of them, and it was said unto them that they should rest yet for a little season, until their fellow servants also and their brethren, that should be killed as they were, should be fulfilled. And I beheld, when he had opened the sixth seal, and lo, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon became as blood, and the stars of heaven fell unto the earth, even as a fig tree casteth her untimely figs, when she is shaken of a mighty wind. And the heaven departed as a scroll when it is rolled together, and every mountain and island were moved out of their places. And the kings of the earth, and the great men, and the rich men, and the chief captains, and the mighty men, and every bondman and every free man, hid themselves in the dens and in the rocks of the mountains, and said to the mountains and rocks, Fall on us, and hide us from the face of him that sitteth on the throne, and from the wrath of the Lamb, for the great day of his wrath is come, and who shall be able to stand? The passage above quoted constitutes the first act in the heavenly drama, that which was represented under the first six seals. Its general subject, I have presumed to be, following a notable prosperous era, the decline and fall of the empire of pagan Rome. And it may be well to anticipate, though it was only in the later part of the prophecy, that the apocalyptic earth was expressly identified with the Roman earth. Yet there was in the emblems of the very first seal, if I mistake not, that which, instead of leaving its reference doubtful or indistinct, must almost at once have suggested the Roman Empire and emperors as its intended subject of figuration. At least to an observer not possessed by other expectations as to the intent of the prophecy, and conversant, like the evangelist, with the manners and customs of the age. The evidence of this I trust soon to bring not only before the mind, but even the eye of the reader. Before doing so, however, it may be useful to make a few preliminary remarks bearing on the right interpretation alike of the symbols of this first seal and of those of the next three following, which four comprehend that quaternion of horses and horsemen, with the succession of which the revelations of the future given to St. John opened. The principles suggested will be found very simple, and such, I trust, as will readily approve themselves to the common sense and the intelligent and candid reader. Number 1. The chronological reference of each vision, as fixed by the prophecy itself, is evidently a point most necessarily to attend to, that of the first seal being determined by its position. Next, after the angel's words, to signify what was to happen soon after the epoch of St. John seeing the visions at Patmos. That of the second, third, and fourth in like manner, being fixed to events or changes that were to have commencing dates, each in chronological sequence to the commencing dates of the events or changes signified in the vision of the seals. Hence, the inadmissibility not merely of such directly anti-chronological explanations as that of the martyrologist Fox and others, which interprets the four horses and horsemen of the four successive military empires of Babylon, Persia, Macedon, and Rome, the three first of which had already been passed away centuries before St. John, but also of others who would interpret them to symbolize the four successive religions of primitive Christianity, Mohammedism, popery, and infidelity, though elsewhere insisting on the establishment of the reign of popery and the popes, as dating near a century before the rise of Mohammedism. Hence, also the probable exclusion of that very old and recently revived explanation, which makes the first seal to symbolize Christianity and its gospel preaching in triumphant progress. The three next several evil agencies of war, famine, and pestilence, introductory to Christ's second advent, these being not supposed to follow each other in any distinctly marked order of chronological sequence on a grand scale, but rather to occur in a series of recurring exemplifications on a small scale, all chronologically intermixed together after the type of those predicted by Christ as what would occur before the destruction of Jerusalem. Number 2. The presumption against this last-mentioned view seems to me strengthened by the fact that abstract ideas, such as of war, famine, and pestilence, are, I believe, never depicted elsewhere in Scripture under the form of symbolic illustrations, after the manner of these introductory seals. Death stands alone in this respect, and, from the very singularity of the circumstance, needed to be specifically named, where his personification occurs in the fourth seal. While war and famine, the supposed subjects of the two preceding symbolic illustrations, are specified in that same seal in simple literal language, as two out of the four agencies by which death was to kill. It will be seen hereafter that the price of barley named in the third seal, as well as what was said of the oil and wine, suffice to put the idea of famine being there intended altogether out of the question. 3. Abstractions being thus presumptuously set aside, we seem very much reduced to the idea of some nation and empire, or else the Christian Church, being the main subject of the four symbolizations. And I think it will be admitted on this head that, whichever of these two be chosen, the homogeneity of the symbols of a horse and horseman, common to the four first seals, would seem to require a homogeneous interpretation of them. Hence the exclusion of views like Meade, who would explain the first seal's horse and rider with reference to Christ or to his church, the next three seals horses and riders with reference to the Roman Empire or emperors. The rule is, of course, applicable in detail. What the horse singly is meant to symbolize in the first seal, whether the church or an empire, that it might reasonably be expected to symbolize in the next three seals, though under new and different aspects. And in the first three seals, the rider, too, ought to be interpreted on the same common principle. I say, in the first three seals, the case of the fourth seal's rider being, as before remarked, peculiar. Number 4. As to the grand question just mooted, whether it be Christ's church or some nation and empire, that is designated under the figure of the horse in the four seals, the presumption in favor of the former idea, which many have entertained, in consequence of it being Christ that appears crowned as the rider on a white horse in a later vision, like as the first seal's rider also sat crowned on a white horse, that presumption, I believe, will utterly vanish before a more careful comparison of the two symbolizations. For the only real point of resemblance will be found to be the mere indistinctive one of riding a white horse, while the differences will appear so many and so marked as to place the two symbolization, so as I have suggested before when speaking of the moral of the drama, in the light of marked contrast, not an identity of subject. The impracticability, according to Vitringa, of carrying out an explanation of the horse and horseman on this system into the second, third, and fourth seals, otherwise than as of one compound emblem, increases the already strong presumption against that view, beside that the fitness of a horse to designate the church, even supposing Vitringa's difficulty to be overcome, seems very questionable. Nor am I persuaded will human learning or ingenuity ever be found able to carry out satisfactorily a detailed historical explanation of the four seals on this view of the horse as signifying the church. Hence, in fine, the a priori probability of the apocalyptic horse meaning a nation or empire, and if so, then of course that nation with which, more than any other, Christ's church both was and was to be locally connected, and which consequently was the subject long before of Daniel's prophecy, the Roman Empire, the circumstance of other heathen nations or empires having been elsewhere similarly symbolized in scripture prophecy, not merely as wild beasts, their emblems in the persecuting character, but under figures also with reference to their mere national history of certain of the domesticated animals, e.g., the Persian nation as a ram, and Macedonian as a goat, is one confirmatory of this view, and the fitness of the war horse, sacred to Mars, to signify the martial Roman nation, especially as they claim to be the offspring of Mars, with Mars for their father, seems almost self-evident, of which their fabled parentage, the memorial we read, was ever publicly pronounced at spring and at autumn, each year as it rolled round, from Romulus's time, it is said, down to the time of the emperors, the Romans being wont to see the horse exhibited in sacrifices and in games as the animal sacred to their father, Mars. Nor, if the appropriateness of the scriptural emblems of the ram and the goat to Persia and Macedon has been evidenced to us by those nations' actual adoption of them for types on their coinage, is similar ocular proof of symbolic fitness wanting in the present instance. Innumerable Latin, or, as I may truly call them, Roman coins, of early date and beautiful fabric, such as the reader now sees engraved before him, still remain to illustrate, to modern eyes, this recognized connection of Mars, the horse, and the Roman people, besides that a horse was also one of the ancient Roman war standards. Nor should I omit to observe, though somewhat anticipative, since symbols were often borrowed from real life, that in the times of St. John, the horse was frequently seen by Romans in association with riders to whom such insignia belonged, as those on the first three seals, the crown, the sword, and the balance. The first more especially, that in this association, moreover, occasion sometimes arose when the horse was viewed ominously, and that it was then, by a natural principle, interpreted with reference to those whom the official rider might be ruler over, that is, a Roman army, or the Roman subjects. The meaning of the apocalyptic horse, thus presumptuously settled, that of the other details of the symbol, will readily suggest itself. Its colors, in the successive seals, marked obviously the successive symptomatic phases that the body politic, which the horse represented, would exhibit, from that of high health and prosperity at the first, to that of mortal dissolution, its riders, the characteristic agents or agencies, by whom, during the times respectively intended, it would be thus acted on and influenced, the instrumental causes, in effect, of these symptomatic phases. To prevent mistake as to the particular agents or agency signified in each case, the rider bore, or had given him, in the successive visions, some distinctive badge of his class, as the crown, bow, sword, balance, and etc. I say of his class, for in each case, I conceive, it was not an individual that the rider was likely to represent, but conformable with the corporate signification of the emblematic horse, and other such symbols in prophecy, a collective body, class, or series. Thus, simply, if I mistake not, were the main points that Gibbon deemed it important to mark in his philosophic history of the Roman Empire, set forth before the evangelists in the four first of the apocalyptic figurations, I mean, not the events or changes alone in that empire's history, but together with them in each case, the instrumental cause and the symptomatic phase. Nor let me omit to add, with reference to the epochs and eras, as well as subjects, chosen, as I presume, for delineation, that they also will be found to well agree with those that Gibbon and other historians make prominent in their pictures, as bearing most importantly on the grand subject of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. Indeed, these epochs and these new agencies for good or evil, then successively introduced, did so bear upon it that, as it seems to me, no philosophic history of the varying fortunes of Imperial Rome during the period they include could omit them. Nor, I may add, does it seem to me that the philosophy of history would require the introduction of any more. Short as are the four figurations, they contain within themselves, I believe, the very spirit of the Roman history for the next two centuries after St. John, up to the memorable epoch of the year 292, when the unity of the empire was practically dissolved. And let me not forget to observe further, before closing this introductory section, that there was then also foreshown to St. John in the fifth seal, though under imagery quite different and peculiar, another and different era and causal agency, which bore yet more directly and strongly on the overthrow of the empire and religion of pagan Rome than even any depicted before. It being so, the fit introduction of the sixth seal's hieroglyphic, charged with the prefiguration of that overthrow, itself the grand consummation of this first act of the heavenly drama. Thus much premised, we proceed more particularly to consider the sacred figurations. On the first seal's opening, the voice of the first of the four living creatures, in sign and token of Christ's already assumed part in the providential government of the world, called as with a voice of thunder, "Come!" And instantly, as if in obedience to the summons, a horse and horseman, with certain peculiar and significant insignia, appeared issuing forth, as I suppose, upon the Roman landscape.
You're listening to FirstAmendmentRadio.com worldwide. Freedom is never free. We need your support today at FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
The program you are listening to is 100% sponsored by you, the listener, on this First Amendment Rights Media channel. You will notice that there are few commercials on this radio network. There's a good reason for that. Corporate advertising dollars come with strings that limit program content. So without your help, these programs cannot continue on satellite, internet, or our several affiliates. If you benefit by the educational law programs, we ask you to give. If you are admonished or nurtured by the Bible and ministry programs, we ask you to give. If some voice a cause that you are passionate about, we ask you to give. If you believe in any of these, we ask you to support them as you would a missionary on a continual basis, as if giving a tithe for missionary radio. These programs are not commercially viable and must be supported by those faithful to the cause of truth. Look for the button to sponsor your favorite programs at our Listen and Schedule pages on the Internet. We will also give you unlimited archive access to all of our programs. We're asking you to give much less than a tithe, so that you may also send support directly to a particular program host, cause, and anywhere else the Spirit may lead you. Do all to the glory of our God and Creator, for His holy nation, the only kingdom that will last forever. Thank you for listening.
Horae Apocalypticae, Volume 1, an historicist commentary on the Revelation, updated and revised for the 21st century, derived from the original work of E.B. Eliot. Read by yours truly, Nicholas Arthur. Part 1, Chapter 1, The First Seal. And what, then, was to be the characteristic state of the Roman Empire, according to the first seal's prefiguration, following after the time then present of the apostles' exile in Patmos? It might not unnaturally have been expected by Christians who, like him, were suffering from Domitian's persecution, that it would not be very long before, under the sentence of God's righteous judgment, the great persecuting empire of heathen Rome would be seen declining towards its dissolution, and truly the vices, follies, and oppressions of the emperor then reigning, just as of most that had preceded him, might suggest an internal cause then already in operation, and moreover, the recent successful incursions of the frontier barbarians, an external one, each apparently almost sufficient of itself to produce that result. But such a result was not indicated to St. John. On the contrary, the first symbol under which the Roman people was represented, to his view, presented it somewhat strangely under the color of triumph, prosperity, and health in the body politic. I looked, and lo, a white horse, and he that sat thereon having a bow, and a crown was given him. And he went forth conquering and to conquer. Combining the chief indications here given, it was as if prosperity, long unknown, would spring up and continue for some considerable time within the empire, a prosperity introduced in some striking manner by wars of victory, and that would be still attended by, and that would be still attended by victory whenever and wherever wars might arise afterwards, even to the end of the period prefigured, to which wars there would be a going forth under guidance answering to that of the crowned bow-bearing rider, thereby assuring the general inviolability from foreign foes, and perhaps advancing the limits and the greatness of the empire. Roman numeral 1. And first, did not this answer very notably and distinctively to the general state and history of the Roman Empire for the 80 or 90 years succeeding John's banishment, that is, from Domitian's death, A.D. 96, throughout the successive reigns of Nerva, Trajan, Hadrian, and the two Antonines, until the accession of Commodus, and triumphant peace made by him with the Germans, A.D. 180, or indeed, yet a year or two farther on, to the completion of his Germanic successes and coincident primary deterioration of his government about 183. I turn to Gibbon, whose history, by a singular coincidence, in respect of commencing date, as well as of subject, agrees with the apocalyptic prefiguration, and I find him, just as in this first seal's symbolic sketch, deferring for a while to enter on his great subject of the decline of the Roman Empire, in order, in the first place, to describe its glory and its happiness in this precise era, as being that which immediately preceded its decline. In fact, he makes it the bright ground, if I may say so, of his historic picture, whereon to trace out afterwards, more effectively in dark coloring, the successive traits of the empire's corruption and decline. He represents it, and his representations are well confirmed by the original histories remaining to us. He represents it as a golden age of prosperity, union, civil liberty, and good government, a period unstained with civil blood, like the white of the first apocalyptic horse, in contrast with the red of the second, and undisturbed by revolution, a period remarkable, both at its commencement and at its close, for very wonderful and almost uniform triumphs in war, whereby the glory of the empire was illustrated, and its limits extended, and of which the middle interval, though not without occasional wars on the frontiers, was generally a time of profound and happy peace. In short, he thus sums up his view of it, quote, "If a man were called to fix the period in the history of the world, during which the condition of the human race was most happy and prosperous, he would, without hesitation, name that which elapsed from the death of Domitian to the accession of Commodus." I said that the wars of the Romans, during this period, were all but uniformly triumphant, and it may be well briefly to particularize on this point, not to rest then on Nerva, primarily Pannonian triumph, which instantly, as the new era opened, served to mark the return of victory under it to the Roman banners. I say, not to rest on this, who knows not of the triumphs under Trajan, the Roman Alexander, by which Dacia, Armenia, Mesopotamia, and other provinces were, in the course of the first 20 years of the period I speak of, added to the Roman Empire. As regards the 43 years which followed, constituting the reigns of Hadrian and Antoninus Pius, though they were years, for the most part, of honorable and glorious peace, yet there was passing wars in each reign sufficient to illustrate the continued fulfillment of the predicted testimony that they should conquer. First, the Jewish war under Hadrian, confined to a single province, in which the rebellion of that unhappy people was put down with fearful slaughter. Then under Antoninus Pius, the lesser wars on the frontiers, just before alluded to, which served not only to exercise the Roman legions, as Gibbon expresses it, but also to deepen the impression on the minds of the barbarians everywhere of the invincibility of the Roman Empire. After this, however, towards the conclusion of the octogenarian period that I speak of, wars arose again, and of so formidable a character as to test to the very uttermost the truth of the prophecy. From east and west, north and south, it seemed as if the whole barbarian world had been stirred from its very foundations to overwhelm the envied glory and prosperity of the empire. And on the sudden surprise, once and again and a third time, alike on the Euphrates and the Danube frontier, the Roman frontier army was overthrown. But so soon as the imperial strength had gathered itself up against the invaders, not only was the invasion on either side, and in every case repelled, but the war earned triumphantly into the invaders' own territory. The Parthian War was successfully ended by the total overthrow of that people, the capture of the chief Armenian and Parthian cities, Artaxata, Seleucia, Ctesiphon, and a readdition to the empire of the great Mesopotamian province, which, originally conquered by Trajan, had, from motives of policy, been voluntarily ceded by Hadrian. And even in the most mighty of all those wars, the Marcomannic, victory after victory still attended the Roman standards under the second Antonine, till the German barbarians, driven into their forests, were reduced to submission. So that the destiny assigned to the white horse's rider, and the conquer, continued to be realized by the Romans, even to the end of the period under review. And as the magnificent Column of Trajan still remains at Rome, the just memorial of the triumphs of its commencement, so it has been ordered that there should remain also that of Antoninus Aurelius, the magnificent, although inferior monument of those of its close. Roman numeral 2. The Empire's Triumphs and Prosperity During the Subject Era. What was the influential agency that would cause these? In other words, who the agents personified by the writer? That which is related of the reigning emperors throughout this era, their absolute authority, for under them, says Gibbon, the Roman Empire was governed by absolute power under the guidance of virtue and wisdom, the armies being restrained by the firm and gentle hand of four successive emperors, and their power used only to cherish the nation's happiness, advance its prosperity, or guide it to its triumphs, must at once have suggested them as the persons symbolized. As Gibbon continues, the delight was theirs of beholding the general happiness of which they were the authors, nor were the visible symbols wanting in the vision to foreshow the same to the evangelist. First, the rider's white horse might suggest it, white having been both, in earlier times, the chosen color for horses used by Roman generals in their triumphs, and still by Roman emperors. Then the crown given him would seem sufficient absolutely to confirm this impression, the triumph and triumphal crown wearing having been from time to time of Augustus all but withdrawn, as too great an honor from subordinate generals, and from Domitian's accession appropriated as his own proper distinctive to the reigning emperor. It so happens, indeed, that as regards this very point, an objection has been made to the effect that the diadem, not the crown, would have been the badge represented if Roman emperors had been symbolized, and that, in fact, instead of the presentation of the crown fixing the meaning to the individuals in that high office, the want of the diadem positively precludes the idea of them being the persons meant. But the objection has been founded evidently on misapprehension. The respectable writer objecting seems to have confounded either between the kingly and imperial offices, or between the practices of the earlier and later Roman emperors. Let me explain. By the emperor, up to the time of Augustus, was meant, as is well known, simply the victorious Roman general, saluted with that title by his soldiers on the field of battle, and with the triumph and its coveted honors and insignia following. Now, though with Augustus and his successors the most absolute monarchical power attached to their emperorship, yet it was their policy to veil it under the old military or imperial badges, hence their public insignia, of which the mock robing and crowning of Jesus by the Roman soldiery is an affecting remembrance, were still the laurel crown and purple robe. The assumption of the diadem, or broad white fillet, set with pearls, viewed as it was by the Romans as a badge of oriental despotism and of the servitude of the subject vassals, these emperors carefully shunned. The remembrance long remained with them of the feelings exhibited by the Roman people on its being offered by Antony to their great ancestor, Julius Caesar, insomuch that it was considered an act of madness on the part of Caligula to attempt to assume it. Abundant memorials exist to show that, all through the time to which our first seal refers, the crown remained the badge of Roman emperors, the diadem of barbarous kings. In fact, not until about the time of Diocletian, near 200 years after St. John's banishment to Patmos, was the diadem adopted by Roman emperors, the innovation being accompanied with the other insignia attendant on Eastern royalty, the personal act of adoration not accepted. The change constituted an epoch in Roman history, and one markedly noticed, as will hereafter appear in the Apocalypse. Thus, then about Diocletian's time, and thence forward, but not until then, the diadem was the imperial badge, for a century or more, conjointly with the laurel, then, I believe, exclusively. So that, whereas, with reference to such a period as the close of the 4th century, it would have been an impropriety, and with reference to the 6th, an anachronism, to represent the laurel crown as a badge of empire on an imperial or royal head. Just as much, and indeed still more, it would have been an anachronism to represent a Roman emperor of the 2.5 centuries with a diadem. Thus, the objection has only led us to see the more clearly the exact chronological propriety, as well as the personal distinctiveness of this particular emblem in the first seal's hieroglyphic. And I cannot but add that the very going forth of the apocalyptic writer and presentation of the crown to him were yet additional points of resemblance in the syndicalism picture to the imperial usages at Rome in the time of St. John. For an emperor's going forth to war was an occasion perpetually taken by the Senate to express their good wishes and their predictions of success, often in those cases falsified. And in token thereof, medals were struck, depicting the emperor galloping forth on horseback, striking down an enemy, and with the legend, Profectio or Expedito Augusti. Further, supposing that success had already begun to favor him in the war, they had a mode of expressing the successes accomplished, as well as those that might be anticipated for the future. He was pictured, it might be, with a captive enemy prostrate at his horse's feet, or else perhaps, whether on a triumphal arch or on terra firma, as going forth between trophies and captives, and with victory in either case crowning, or with crown in hand preceding him. Such is the device on a medal of the Emperor Claudius, with the exergue De Britannis underneath in memorial of his conquest of Britain. Such, more fully, that on another, which depicts a triumphal arch erected to that emperor's father, Claudius Drusus, after victories over the Germans, of which latter an engraved is appended. And I think that after viewing it, and considering what has been also further observed respecting the crown and the white horse, the reader will deem me justified in expressing the like persuasion in the introduction to this chapter, to the effect that a person conversant, like St. John, with the Roman usages of the age, could scarcely but have had suggested to his mind, a priori, by these emblems of the first seal, the idea of a Roman emperor speeding forth to victory. It is observable that medallic memorials still remain of the 5 several emperors in question, depicting them, more or less fully, under guise of these self-same semi-apocalyptic devices, the 2 chief conquerors, Trajan and M. Aurelius, riding forth as in the Profectio Augusti, and all the 5 either crowned or with the crown held out to them by victory. And in their cases, we know, the medals spoke truth, not as in some other cases, mere false flattery. One objection, however, may still present itself. One difficulty seemed to stand in the way of this, our imperial application of the prophetic symbol. I mean the fact that of the rider having a bow in his hand, for the weapon represented in the hands of Roman emperors on medals and other extant monuments of antiquity is generally the javelin, sometimes the sword, never, so far as I know, the bow, and hence indeed the Tringa. Though not unconscious of the general fitness of the emblem of a crowned rider on a white horse going forth conquering and to conquer, to depict the era of prosperity and triumph under the five Roman emperors whose reigns followed next after the date of the apocalyptic visions, yet argues that the bow was an Asiatic and barbarian weapon and badge, and purposely inserted into the hieroglyphic to divert the thoughts of the observer from the Roman Empire and emperors, in which view he has been followed by other commentators. But is this correct? Was the bow a badge of Asiatic and other barbarians only? Was there not one particular province and people among the provincials of the Roman Empire of whom it was also distinctive? Distinctive not equally alone, but even almost more than of any barbarian people whatsoever. If the reader will consult the records of antiquity, he will find that such was indeed the case with the island and islanders of Crete. Alike, their colonial origin, mythological traditional legends, military history, and manufacture attest this peculiar connection to the Cretans and the bow. As to their origin, it appears from ancient authors that Crete was originally peopled, in part at least, from that part of Palestine situated on the Mediterranean coast, which was by the Arabs called Caritha, and by the Syrians Creth, its inhabitants bearing the similar Hebraic appellation Crethim, as the 70 have translated it, respecting which Crethim, Bocart adds, that they were noted archers, some of them deployed by David as his life guard. It is Sir Isaac Newton's supposition that Crete was thus peopled from Palestine about 1045 BC, when many of the Phoenicians and Syrians fled from King David into Asia Minor, Crete, Greece, and Libya. Others date the migration earlier, but whatever the epoch, this is certain, that in Crete itself the archery habits of the Syrian Crethim colonists, as well as their name, remained. The earliest traditional legends of the Cretan islanders ascribe a similar preeminence in the art to those of their forefathers that were in the island native-born. It is told to us by Diodorus Siculus that Apollo, the Cretan Apollo, was affirmed in these legends to have been the first inventor of the bow, and how he taught the natives archery, whence their superior skill in the art before and above all men. Memorial Cretan medals, of which traditions are still extant, struck in the Roman imperial times, some bearing the device of Apollo and his bow, some of Diana and her bow, with the inscription, Community of Crete. Descending from the times of legendary fable to those of real history, we find the connection of the bow and the Cretan islanders constantly marked thenceforward for ages. In the military annals of the neighboring states, among Homer's heroes, it was the Cretan Murion that bore away the palm in archery. By Pindar, the appellation bowman was attached as a distinctive appellation to the Cretan islanders. And Pausanias states that in those earlier historic times, the Cretans alone of all the Greeks were archers, impugning the correctness of a piece of sculpture which represented Diitrephes as pierced by arrows, his slayers being other Greeks, not Cretans. With reference to later times, Thucydides relates how in the Peloponnesian War, archers were fetched by the belligerent parties from Crete. As regards those of Macedonian supremacy, we are reminded of the same fact by Plutarch, and with reference to those of Roman greatness, from the Carthaginian Wars down to those of Caesar, when Crete had been made a Roman province, and afterwards, as late even as the reign of Claudius Gothicus in the 3rd century. By Polybius, Livy, Lucan, Hurtius, and Trabellius Pollio. it was suggested by astronomers, in explanation of the fact of their long-continued eminence in the art, that Crete lay under the zodiac sign of the archer, Sagittarius. Moreover, the Cretan manufacture of bows and arrows was celebrated. No European bow was noted like theirs. The name Cretan, in fact, came to be attached as an appellative to bows, and it was a natural device impressed on their metals. I append one as a specimen, and subjoin the observations on the device as a Cretan distinctive of a Roman poet and German medalist. Under all which circumstances, can I be wrong in stating that the bow was preeminently a Cretan weapon and badge, or in inferring that, when a bow was pictured emblematically before St. John in a European warrior's hands, the intention would be to signify that the warrior was of Cretan origin. In fact, it happens that, over and above all the other accumulated evidence just adduced, we have extant a Greek epigram or epitaph consisting of a set of emblems, including an express explanation to this effect. A magpie sculpture on the tombstone was to mark the loquacity of the person whose epitaph it was, the cup, her proneness to drink, the wool, her diligence in work, the bow, what did the bow mark? It is explained that this was to signify that she was a Cretan. I must confess that, considering the important bearing of this point on the commencement, and consequently on the whole scheme of apocalyptic interpretation, it has seemed to me a matter for thankfulness that so illustrative an epigram should have been preserved to us. But what is the application of all this, you may be thinking, to the point in hand? Or how does what we have inferred attach to the emblem of a bow to connect itself with the symbol of the first seal, and its imperial horsemen riding on to triumph? I now proceed to explain. Down to the accession of Otho, the reigning Caesars, from Julius to Galba inclusive, were of old Roman families. Agreeably with the Roman jus imaginum, they exhibited in their halls the busts of a long line of Roman nobles, their ancestors, whether of the Julian gens, the Claudian, or the Sulpician. And as for Otho, Vitellius, Vespasian, and Vespasian's two sons, Titus and Domitian, if not all of Roman, yet they were of Italian extraction, and indeed Otho of an Italian family still more ancient and noble than all the rest, for he was descended from the Etruscan kings. But after Domitian, there was a notable change on this head in the character of the imperial succession. It is said to have been pre-intimated in a dream a little before his death. To Domitian, he dreamed, says Suetonius, that a neck of gold appeared to grow branching off from his own neck, behind, that which so branched off, implying a new line of emperors, and the gold, their character as introducers of a golden age. Another historian, Aurelius Victor, expressly sets forth the novel character of this line as a fact very remarkable in respect of its being one of princes of foreign extraction. Quote, "Hitherto men of Roman or Italian origin ruled the empire. From after this time, foreigners in extraction," in which statement he is followed, indeed copied, by the younger Victor. And they both note at the same time the increased happiness that accrued to the empire from the innovation. And what then was the foreign country or province to which the five emperors might be ascribed, as to lineage and family, that followed next after Domitian, and introduced and kept up this golden age of the empire? Prior to which question, another must indeed first be answered. Can they all be classified together under one and the same head and family? The answer to which the latter question is, that they may be so classified together, because, in a manner quite unparalleled in the subsequent history of the Roman emperors, they were all connected, as in the line of one and the same family, by successive adoptions. Trajan was adopted by Nerva, Hadrian by Trajan, Antoninus by Hadrian, Aurelius by Antoninus, each as their medals and their extant memorials of antiquity illustrate to us, taking the name of his predecessor in virtue of the adoption. Thus, according to the well-defined Roman law of adoption, all were reckoned as of Nerva's family, he being the head of the line. And what was Nerva's own national origin and extraction? In Dion Cassius, we find what is evidently an allusion to him, as an Italiot, which word will be, by a reader versed in Greek language, be well understood to mean a colonist of Greek extraction, settled in Italy. His exact Greek provincial origin, however, he does not mention, but Aurelius Victor supplies the omission. He tells us, and most of our best-known modern historians of the earlier emperors of Rome repeat the statement, that Nerva was, in respect of family extraction, a Cretan. So, yes, the meaning of the bow in the rider's hand is now indeed manifest, and how admirable, beyond what the most learned of human artists or scholars would have devised, appears the point in the comprehensiveness of this device of the divine spirit. Had a javelin or a sword been in the hand of the rider, so as Vatringa would have had it, in case of his representing Roman emperors, the weapon carried would have added precisely nothing either to the meaning or the distinctness of the hieroglyphic, the crown sufficing to designate emperors, and the javelin and the sword, although appropriate, not being distinctive of them. But by the addition of the bow held in the hand, observe, before the crown was given him, there was prefigured the very province of the family to which the empire within a year from after the visions in Patmos was destined to be committed, and under which, in a measure quite unprecedented, the symbolic horse was to assume and to retain the white color, the Roman nation to flourish in prosperity, and in its wars, both at first and whenever afterwards occurring, to realize the predicted destiny of conquering and to conquer.
I believe the day is coming when every knee will bow and all the people of the earth will worship the Lamb of God. Oh, thank you, Lord. We sing these songs to you tonight, Jesus.